This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Kelly Anissa. Afifa Said is a cultural anthropologist with a focus on grassroots development with a special interest in youth and women. So she has worked for over 20 years with various international and grassroots NGOs as well as United States and international development agencies. Afifa is currently in Malaysia to give a series of talks on parenting and education. So on today's show, she shares her thoughts on her advocacy work involving the youth and women and the role of religion in development. Here to tell us more about that today is Afifa herself. Welcome to the show, Afifa.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you with us. So tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, why did you decide to be a cultural anthropologist?
That's a really good question that I ask myself regularly. I think cultural anthropology is really a framework and a perspective that I was drawn towards because of my own life experience. I was born in Kashmir in India. My family migrated to the U.S. when I was 5. And growing up in the U.S., really trying to figure out, you know, issues of identity, meaning, you know, some people will call it third culture identity, which is you're born somewhere, you live somewhere else. And you're growing up with so many different exposures to so many different identities and ways of life. And that led me to think about, you know, what is it about identity that can be understood, you know, as a framework and then put into place in practice in our daily lives. And I think for me, growing up in America with parents who had decided that we were going to be staying in America and so therefore going to embrace the American identity, realizing that even though we were embracing it, we weren't necessarily seen as American by the people that lived there. But then also realizing that when we went back to visit in Kashmir, I was also not considered Kashmiri because I was too American to be Kashmiri. So that unique experience of trying to belong somewhere really drives us as individuals to think about, you know, is identity something that you can create and nurture on your own, or is it something imposed from outside? And if it's imposed from outside, do you have to fit into some sort of, you know, box just to be that which people define you as? So that's been really a journey for me, both in terms of my personal identification and development, but then also realizing that, yes, actually identity is something that you can take ownership of, and within the context that you live in, can explore different aspects of it. So that's, you know, It's both been a career or a professional development aspect, but then also I've been able to see identity formation in various ways through the journey, which is looking at if you're going to have identity that is created and is something you take ownership of, then you have a responsibility towards that. And it could be in your own life, but also in your community. So for some of my work in America, it's been about American Muslim identity. How does that fit into the larger context of being an American? And those have been some really great conversations. And then also actual work on the ground where, you know, we brought together young Muslims that were from various cultures themselves, but identified as Americans, and some people that had come from convert families where they had converted to Islam. And so therefore their idea of being Muslim in America was also unique and something that we learned from. And building that American identity, American Muslim identity within the American identity has been, I think it's been a great way of contributing to the conversation about identity in America overall. So all of us can very confidently say, yes, I am an American, because what it means to be American means to be able to embrace all your identities, if you have them, but also understand that it's something that you create and you build upon.
I see. And, you know, what are some of your main areas of interest? I mean, you mentioned working with, you know, that American Muslims and trying to foster that American Muslim identity. You know, what other areas do you also focus on?
So I think what's interesting about identity or about, you know, even building community is you look at all the different aspects that go along with it. So I would think that a lot of the work that I've done, and I know sometimes it seems like it's all over the place, it's all different kinds of things, but in my mind, there's a common thread. And that thread is, you know, creating and developing identity, because some of the work that I was doing, whether it was academic or it was more, you know, theoretical, also kind of peters down into, well, if we're looking at community, what are the institutions and community that we need to have for a community to thrive? So within the American Muslim community, one of the things that came up very quickly was education. And how do we both affect education that's existing? So we were very much involved, you know, all through the years in public education in the U.S., but also looking at what are some models of innovative education and what does that look like with regards to identity? And how do we help schools and help education policy take into consideration this big piece that is called identity that not everybody can really define that well.
Right.
And then how do you take that into an education model, right? So that mm-hmm. would look like, that turns out looking like, what does a school look like that would have that aspect to it? Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, then what are the different aspects that kind of thread out from there? So it could be education policy, it could be curriculum development, but it also is identity within, you know, how do you connect these young people and their education with the larger globe and their global identity as well as citizens? So that's been a big piece of my work as far as education.
You did start an academy, Al Fateh Academy. It's a school. You know, maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about, you know, what kind of school is that and what are, you know, what are your goals with it? What do you hope to accomplish with Al Fateh Academy?
Well, this school is now 20 years old, so we're very excited to have celebrated that milestone. Mm. And, you know, really, it started because I had my own kids. And as much as I have, you know, faith and I have confidence in our public education system in the U.S., I do because I came through it myself. But we wanted to create for our children, and we, meaning myself and a few other parents who were in education, we really wanted to create an incubator where we could work on some of the issues of identity, but also, you know, looking at innovative practices in education in a place that we could do it on our own terms, and yet be very clearly aligned with the standards of the country, mm-hmm. right? So that our students and our children are definitely performing much higher standard-wise, but they're following the same standards, so they're getting the same education. But then be able to do things differently. So we don't have textbooks. We look at education as much more holistic, and we integrate all the subjects. So whether it's math or science, English, language, or history, it's all approached in a very integrated way. And the other major piece also is, you know, how do we build within these students the skills set and also the qualities of empathy and of perseverance and of, you know, confidence, but also understanding that, you know, you can see people from a different perspective and so on. So that's all part of the curriculum as well, mm-hmm. as well as stewardship and taking care of the earth and taking care of our environment.
Hmm. And I mean, besides education, I mean, you have a wide range of expertise, just reading about, you know, the kind of work that you've done. Could you elaborate more about the different areas of experience?
So my work in education, again, came from this idea of how do we bring disparate pieces together to make, in this case, education more innovative, right? So that is, I, as a cultural anthropologist, I'm not trained as an educator. But I was bringing that piece into this conversation about education. And then beyond that, we also started to look at, you know, what are the pieces that are missing when we bring people to a table to discuss anything, whether it's policy or programming. And that led me to think about one of the pieces that seems missing in conversations is even religion or religiosity. And so that's obviously part of identity, but it's also a big piece on its own. What does religion look like as far as how it's taught in various contexts? Why do we have to teach religion in a certain way? And what are some problematic themes about how we teach religion in the past and even, you know, in the present in some ways? And that's led me to some of the work that I did with, you know, for some people, this is a negative correlation, but it exists, which is looking at religious extremism and looking at, you know, religious extremism to the point where religion is being used in a negative way. So that work led me looking into the intersection between education, right? But now also looking at young people and how they're being affected and influenced by extremism. So to me, it was a natural kind of a progression of efforts and work. And really, it's about, again, about identity and looking at young people who want to belong and don't feel belonging somewhere, so they are being connected to or attracted to frames of reference that are not only problematic, but in this case, you know, violent and extremist and so on. So that's another piece of it. And then the young people, the youth themselves, how do we reach them in a way that makes sense to them rather than just trying to say, you know, what you're doing is wrong or what you're doing is illegal in some ways. It's also, what is it, how can we counter that without just being, you know, political about it? So that's been a big piece of that. And then beyond that, another sort of an orbit that I've been in that's it's related is looking at when we're doing something like as big as international development, right, which is, many people define it very differently, but it is, it's economic development in a country, it's social development, and so on, and all the pieces that go along with that. So because I was looking at grassroots development and identity and how communities themselves solve their own problems, I started this critique of international development that comes from an anthropological perspective, which really says, look, if we're going to do imposed international development because we want to make the world a better place, why aren't we seeing that bear fruit? And really, it's because we're not taking into consideration people's own identity, people's own aspirations within a community. So we started to look at grassroots development as being a response to international imposed development, but then just breaking it down to reality, which what does that really mean? And it means who's at the table when we are creating policies on international development? Who's at the table when we are deciding what the priorities are in a country? So then we started to realize, well, there are people missing at the table, which have a big say both in how to develop programs, but then also looking at, you know, are these things working or not? Mm. So in that case, we found out, well, actually, a big piece that's missing many times is traditional leaders or religious leaders who many people say kind of write off as being, well, they're not part of development because they're outside of that whole realm. And I've talked to various people at very high ministerial levels that say, no, we just need to ignore religious leaders when we do development because they just hold us back. Well, the reality is these religious leaders and religious institutions or traditional institutions, if not religious, are actually where people go to almost on a first, you know, as a first contact when they need health issue, when they have health issues or they have education concerns and so on, or disputes. They go to their religious traditional leaders and institutions and ask and try to get that help from there so that we can't ignore them. So instead, we kind of flipped it around and said, well, how do we develop their capacity as traditional leaders and so on to be a part of development rather than being, a side note or not being, you know, an active part of it? So that was another piece that I've been working through. And then a subset of that is women of faith. So women leaders, where is their place in the work that we do in community development? What do they bring to the table that's more unique? And then how are we not engaging them proactively, which could really affect development outcomes? So these are the different nodes that I've been working with. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I do see, you know, some people think of them as separate buckets, but to me, that's just a natural progression and connection between them, mainly because I think all these pieces come together to look at sustainable programming, sustainable community development, can have larger impact than just saying, oh, you know, we have all these great programs around a country that really don't go anywhere. And in fact, what I'm really concerned about is do more harm. If they may not have any impact, or they might do more harm because we're not engaging the right folks at the right time.
I am speaking to Afifa Said. She is a cultural anthropologist. Afifa is currently in Malaysia to give a series of talks on parenting and education. So on today's show, she shares her thoughts with us on her advocacy work involving the youth and women and the role of religion in development. We will be right back after the break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. I am speaking today to Afifa Said. She is a cultural anthropologist. So Afifa is currently visiting Malaysia to give a series of talks on parenting and education. On today's show, she shares her thoughts on some of her advocacy work involving the youth and women and the role of religion in development. You also worked as a senior advisor at the U.S. Agency for International Development. What kind of work did you do there in your capacity as a cultural anthropologist? And, you know, just taking into account some of the sort of advocacy that you've been working on.
So I spent most of my academic career before joining USAID. I was bashing USAID. I was a huge critic of it. In fact, I was a huge critic of international development models, and mainly because of my background in grassroots development. And we really took to heart this idea that any kind of imposed development, any kind of this huge, you know, behemoth organizations are really not effective and also, like I was saying earlier, ineffective. So that was my career. And then suddenly this position opened up at USAID in D.C., Washington, D.C., which was pretty much what we were advocating for, myself and many other anthropologists saying, look, we need people in there, in international development organizations, within the structure to not just create awareness, but actually help develop and institutionalize an approach to development that's more effective. So what does that look like? So part of my portfolio was looking at social soundness analyses, which means really getting folks that are in development, especially the funding side of it, to make sure that they take into consideration the social impact of development projects, right? And also take into consideration what are cultural norms in a community or in a country or in a culture that would maybe not make sense to have certain development projects take place. And that can be as simple as making sure that, again, we have the right people at the table, but we also understand that there's knowledge that we don't have and that we have to spend time and effort to look for, to ask the right questions so we get the right answers. And then lastly, a big part of my work, both on the policy side and the programming side at USAID, and of course I was working with other development agencies, was to also kind of reframe development. So instead of coming around and saying, hey, we need to solve all these problems that people are having, development problems, instead we flip it and say, what's working? And that there's so much happening right in communities and in countries, but because we're so bent on solving problems, we have to look for the problems. And if we don't find them, we have to sort of contrive them, which is very problematic in and of itself. So then it was, working on actual analyses that funding partners or donors and development agencies would put out as an analysis, and part of that analysis is to identify what's working rather than just the problem. So a lot of this is, you know, sitting down and having these conversations, but the next step of it is how do you operationalize these? And a big piece also that I was interested in is looking at the role of religion in development, like I mentioned earlier. So part of my portfolio was developing strategies and policies for development agencies on engaging religion. So I was very excited when we were able to put out from the White House in the U.S. a policy on engaging religiosity and religion for development and for foreign policy. And it became kind of a standard for many other agencies to use. And I think, you know, being a part of the institution that I was with USAID and then working with others gave me the ability to have the platform itself to have people to come together to discuss this in an open fashion rather than saying that, you know, well, we have these models we've been using and we have a cookie-cutter approach and it's going to just work wherever we go, to be able to really deconstruct that and say, why doesn't it work? And then another big part of my work while I was there was also institutionalizing training for people that are going into the field of development and making sure they have the skills and the tools to ask some of these questions and also to be able to implement them in programming. So it was both on the policy programming part and also the capacity, building capacity of the development agencies.
And I mean, you've advised the White House, and the UN Democracy Fund, the World Bank, and various in-country governments and non-governmental institutions on, you know, some of the same issues involving communities in Europe, Southeast Asia, South Asia, and Central Asia, and even the Middle East. You know, what are some of the pressing issues in these parts of the world based on, you know, the work that you do?
Trying to distill issues and concerns and priorities across, you know, so many different countries and so many different experiences, it is difficult. And it is difficult to say, well, you know, here's the top issues that everybody has that we have to address. Because again, it goes back to, you know, my efforts in making sure that we really are contextualizing, right? And the problem becomes when we say, for example, women's rights or women's issues, and we say, oh, all across the board, you know, women do not have rights and these are all the issues and so on. So we have to have this this menu of programs or policies. And then the issue becomes, well, it's not going to work the same in one country as it is another, right? So for the very least, what I'm advocating for is let's just take each community. And even, I would say community, because even within a country, you have differences, right? And a major, major part of the concern is being able to understand that, you know, a culture is not just a monolith. A country is not a monolith. And understanding the differences between that, again, which takes time and effort. So I wouldn't be able to sit here and say, well, all these, you know, different countries have X, Y, Z issues. I do think we need to take the time to get into them. However, there are things that kind of percolate up, right? One of the things that I think, mentioned it earlier, this concern about development within a country and what does that look like. We are looking at alternatives to what we've been using as development frameworks. We meaning those of us that have been critical of it. But it's become so institutionalized that everybody has, you know, these buckets of economic development, health, education, so on. And so we're looking at sort of repeating a lot of the same things. So what we're trying to look at is, can we think of development rather than just being something that you're fixing, like I said before, but also looking at it in terms of, you know, is there a different approach, like social entrepreneurship, for example? What does that look like in each country? And could that actually solve problems more than just this international development model that's been, you know, perpetuated? If we look at education models across all of these different countries and different contexts, can we then within education look at social impact and look at how that can be taught in schools rather than just, you know, education for the sake of knowledge, but then education with an impact? And I do think that is very much across the board. That's something that we can look at across cultures, but then again, making it culturally contextualized. And then engagement of youth, especially. I think that has become, and it has been an issue, but it's also been sort of a watered-down issue where it's just kind of like, well, let's just engage the youth for the sake of engagement. Well, the youth themselves are saying, look, we don't want to just be, you know, part of, you know, you just invite us to different trainings or whatever. It has to be something much more sustained and much more consistent as engagement, and that they need to be in the room and at the table when we're discussing issues of the country, because they have a lot to contribute. And we've seen that time and again. So that would be something else that I think across the board is something to consider.
And so, I mean, maybe we could just narrow that, those observations down to, say, Malaysia. You know, how do you see these issues panning out in a country like ours here?
So I've been lucky and blessed to come to Malaysia off and on for the last, I think, about 15 years or so. When I first came was in 1994 or 5, I think. I remember it distinctly because I was pregnant with my second one, and I got to experience my pregnancy here. In any case, from that time, and in that time, actually, I was working on a part of my thesis, which was looking at youth movements and then religious identity within youth movements. So I was looking at the context here in Malaysia as well. So from that time to now, it's been fascinating to watch, what is in some ways an experiment that was from that time to now. In some ways, it's something to watch from outside as far as, you know, even modeling for the rest of the world. And I know many folks across the world are looking at Malaysia in terms of, well, here's a multicultural, you know, society. Here's our young society. Here's a society that is progressing, you know, phenomenally economically over the years. Whatever the ups and downs have been, you know, whatever the issues have been, political and otherwise, still it's just, you know, what was put into place and the trajectory of Malaysia as a country has been something that everybody, you know, from the outside has been looking at very intensely, right? So I think, you know, what I've been, again, as an anthropologist, I'm always very interested in the identity issue here in Malaysia and how that plays out.
Mm.
And especially looking at, you know, I've been talking to lots of young people going to school and sort of looking from their perspective of how do they identify themselves in this country. And I do think from what I can tell and so on is that having more of those conversations and trying to understand how self-identification takes place and then imposed identification as well, what does that look like, is something that definitely, I mean, I know it's happening, but it seems like that might be, you know, a place or a space that we need to have more discussions about. I mean, it's really interesting to me that whether I talk to an Indian or a Malay or a Chinese or anything in between about what do they see as concerns, and each is telling me separately, you know, we are concerned about racism. We are concerned about multiculturalism being a buzzword and not truly embraced. And then also looking at, you know, how do these identifications sort of create this national identity of being Malaysian, which I know it has been in the works and it's something exciting to watch. And again, I'm, you know, also talking to young people a lot about their role in all of that. And I think over these years that I've been watching and observing and being excited about it, the globalization factor, of course, has played a big part. Whether it's in identification or it's in, you know, what are some contributions that Malaysia can make in that arena of global citizenship, I think is something that we're looking forward to learning more about and having Malaysia and Malaysians themselves be a bigger part of that conversation and then bring back from that conversation to what they see their own country looking like and being excited about it. If nothing else, you know, I think Malaysians inspire the rest of us, you know, to look at being much more politically engaged because that is something that, you know, is great and it's wonderful to watch that. Malaysians also are very much concerned about the betterment of their country as a whole. And you see that across the board. You know, nobody's saying, well, I don't feel Malaysian, so I'm not going to be a part of it. I think that identification is so strong. So that's really exciting, too. And that goes into what does it mean to have a Malaysian progress and all of that from your own perspective and your own framework rather than using other peoples from outside. So that's really encouraging.
And also, as you've mentioned previously, your work tends to focus on the youth, women and faith, you know. And how do these issues involving all these three different areas, differ in the developing world? So, I mean, if we were to narrow it down, let's say in Southeast Asia.
So in terms of differences, yeah, I think, you know, how we look at women's role in communities should be very much centered and grounded in where we're talking about. At the same time, I mean, we don't want to create a whole cultural relativism space, which is like, you know, it has to be within the culture, and therefore, if there's an issue within the culture, then we just have to kind of accept it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do is create frameworks of reference and also kind of like, you know, what are the questions to ask, right? So that just means that when I'm in the U.S. working on some of these issues, some of the questions about women's role or women's involvement is going to be a little bit different. I mean, well, the questions will be the same, which is, are women, what's the level of involvement, right? And how do we measure that? That could be the same anywhere. But I think looking at, for example, in some spaces, if you say, well, women are very involved because, look, we had 100 women at this training. So therefore, you know, check the box and women are being trained and so on. But that's not necessarily the right question. It isn't how many women are in the room getting a training or being involved. The question is, what is the impact of that women's involvement having on different issues? There may be certain spaces, for example, where women in some cultures don't have the microphone or don't have a podium which means they don't speak from that, so they're not visible. If we are using the measurement of visibility and saying, well, this many women are in leadership roles, right? When we really, the question is to say, how are women leading, right? Because then you'll find out in some places, especially more traditional spaces or places where women don't have a considerable visible role, they may be influencers in other ways. We just haven't measured that, or we haven't asked that question. And the reality is, in some places, you know, the progress made, for example, with women's participation may be at a different increment than in other places. But we still have to consider that progress, and we still have to consider that incremental space as, I mean, we still have to count it. Mm. The problem becomes when we have a metric where you say, well, this should happen by this time, and if it doesn't, then we haven't made progress, right? Well, that's not necessarily fair, because you have to be able to put it all into perspective. I do a lot of work actually mentoring women of faith leaders. So we have a fellowship. It's the Center for Women, Faith, and Leadership, based in Washington, D.C., but it's a global organization. And we work with women fellows around the world. And it's taught me so much, because these are women that are women of faith. They identify as women of faith, very different faiths. But they're working in spaces like human trafficking. They're working on youth engagement. They're working on you know, other aspects of development and community work. But they don't foremost identify themselves as leaders. Like, they won't come and they won't say, I am a woman leader. They're just doing the work, right? So a lot of times people kind of get frustrated with what's wrong with these women that they don't want to identify as leaders, right? So we kind of unpack that and say, well, okay, what do we mean by when we say women leaders? What are the expectations that are put on those women? And why is it that these women don't want to, right? And we talk through that, and we, especially when I talk with these women, they're like, well, we don't necessarily want to have a title. We just want to do the work. Basically, they're saying, get out of our way. Don't, you know, bother us about the titles and let us do the work, which is great. Yeah. But then it could also be detrimental in the sense of then we can't say that we have all these women in leadership positions and so on and so forth. So these are the, again, these are the nuanced conversations. But then at the same time, we, you know, we're able to track and say, no, actually, many of these issues have influence and are affected by women leaders, and not just women leaders, but the leadership styles that women have is a whole nother piece that we need to look at. And we've been doing that diligently, is saying, how do women lead differently than men? And is it, it's not necessarily just in comparison to men, but what are the things that women are bringing to leadership roles that are, that could be more effective than the way that men, the ways that men lead, or others, well, men and women lead differently. So that's a whole nother space, I think, that we're interested in. And sometimes it does break down into, well, women from more traditional societies versus more, you know, so-called modernist societies. Is there a difference in that? But for sure, it's something that we want to look more closely at, and then, you know, be able to share that information and that those kind of findings of where women are leading and how they're leading.
You know, with the work that you do, you know, involving all these different communities and all these different areas in social issues, especially with faith and religion, you know, what is the most challenging aspect of that part of the job for you, you know, in, or even in your advocacy, you know, taking into consideration the current political climate in the United States now? Mm.
So the current political climate in the United States is really an interesting time, is how many of us are looking at it, because it's bringing to the fore lots of conversations, for sure, but also a lot of self-reflection for us as Americans. And I think the net of that is a good thing, which means we're looking at, again, what it means to be an American, right? And that aspect of identity, and to be able to be very confident in saying, look, there's nobody that just looks like an American, right? I am an American and I look like this, and you're an American, and so on and so forth. So that part of the conversation is very, very important. The other part of it, which, you know, we're looking at, the you know, you could say that the political climate is such that it's bringing out people's voices that we haven't heard. Or some people say they haven't heard. Some of us have heard these voices in many different contexts, but some people would say, well, I didn't realize America had these kinds of people, that we're, you know, that are saying certain things or have certain views that may be contrary to their views. Mm. But again, the fact of the matter is when you have a healthy society, then the differing views come to the fore, and we have to engage them and understand why they're there and where are they coming from. And at the same time, also be very much clear that issues of social justice and issues of, you know, whether it's human rights or it's just civil rights, they have to be upheld, right? And again, this goes back to me as somebody that's working in education and so on, is looking at it as, well, what do we learn from all of this, and how do we bring that back into building citizenship that is informed? And so, again, we're looking at education and curriculum. You know, what do we put into the curriculum at an early stage so we're able to respond to some of these issues that are coming up in a more sustained and institutionalized way? And then if we want an American to be someone who is engaged, who is informed, who is passionate about, you know, what the values of being an American are, then we have to figure out how to make that happen. And it's not just going to happen. It has to be something conscientiously built up. So that's what I would say about the political climate at this point. And again, you know, what you would relate to that is we do have more and more people that are very interested in engaging and engaging on different levels. So we've got lots more people running for office, for example, standing up for candidacy, which is exciting to see. We have lots more people that are, you know, taking into serious consideration the power of voting, where, yeah, you know, it's unfortunate, and you know, we've been sad about it for so long that our voter turnout is really not good, especially compared to the rest of the world, and it's mainly because people, you know, either are apathetic or ill-informed, and so that's taken on a new life of its own, which is let's get people to understand why it matters, and also why local elections matter, and running for local office, which affects your life much more than some of the national stuff does. So that's also been something that's been sort of because of the times, or because, you know, of the climate, it's been pushing people to be more proactive.
Yeah. So you did run for office in 2003. You know, what inspired you to do that? You know, tell me more about that experience.
So I like to practice what I preach, so to speak. And I, you know, I do encourage people to be as engaged as possible, whatever level of engagement is possible. And I was, you know, at that point in the early 2000s, it was also a climate in many ways of disengagement, and people were very concerned about, you know, there's all sorts of different things happening in American society. That's lending towards sometimes more negativity between groups overall. Some of it had to do with post-9/11 concerns. Some of it had to do with just, you know, various other elements. So partly that propelled me to think about running for office. But then I think much more genuinely that I like to reflect on that experience was really thinking to myself, I live in a community, and I want to see my community prosper and do well. And by community, I mean very, very, it's a small level. I meant my neighborhood, and I meant, you know, the city that we lived in and the county that we have, the way that we have broken down in the U.S. So I take to heart that being an American for me, and having decided that I am an American in every way possible, that with, in addition to being a person of faith, where my faith dictates to me, look, wherever you live, you need to take care of it. Mm. That to me is a faith inspired, you know, obviously it comes from many different places, but for me, my faith tells me you are responsible for the community you live in. So I took that idea, and I took the understanding that I was living in a community or a county, for example, that was developing very fast. So development meaning lots of building, lots of you know, businesses cropping up, so on and so forth, and it was affecting the quality of life. So I understood it to be, look, I have something I can offer as far as sustained and managed growth, and I can put that as a platform. It's something that people are interested in and is a concern. So that, coupled with the idea that that I could make a difference in my local politics and local community. And then I think on top of that, which was just, for me, it was extra, but I know it affected, or it was something that a lot of people brought up, was also to be able to say, look, I may not look like your average or what you think of as a typical American, but these are my issues are American issues. Mm-hmm. And my faith doesn't have anything to do specifically with me wanting to make wanting to be in politics, but it inspires me to do good for my community. But it's not that, you know, I'm going to be running because I'm a Muslim, right? So that was kind of the framing of it. But what was the most exciting part about it is I had, because it's a local election, I knocked on, you know, more than 5,000 doors and 5,000 homes. And this is the way that we run our elections, is I would knock on the door and say, hi, my name is Afifa Saeed. I'm running for local office, and I'm here to hear your concerns. Mm-hmm. So imagine doing that, you know, door to door to door. And it was remarkable to me because I had a door to door, I had a conversation at these doors with people with no filter, with no, you know, added layers of politics or whatever. I mean, the other layers that come in. And it was just this honest conversation. So that was back then. And, you know, in terms of my involvement in politics per se, I wasn't then, and I'm not now seeking to be a career politician. Mm-hmm. I do think that my strengths and my interests are outside of the election cycle per se. So I'm very happy since then to have supported and helped other people that do want that track to be much more involved. And again, that's also been across the board. We've been very much concerned about having more minority representation in our government, and also making sure that these issues that are being addressed are universal issues for many, many people.
So what's next for you? You're in Malaysia for a talk that you're giving. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
So the topic of the challenges of parenting in these times and, kind of related to that. So a lot of the education pieces that we're talking about, we're really also focusing on obviously education in schools, but we also have the bigger component is parenting and that connection between parent and school and parent and education. What I really want to think through in this conversation that we have is what does it even mean, you know, to have challenging times or to have difficult times? How do parents look at that? And then what's the role of parents across the board in terms of what are the responsibilities we have as parents in terms of what kind of environment we create for our students? And then what's the reality for our children? And what's the reality of that? Mm-hmm. A lot of us as parents think, oh, we've got it all figured out. But then the issue is really, what are the challenges to that? And how can we approach it in a more systematic way and then support each other?
I see. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the show today, Afifa.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
I've been speaking to Afifa Saeed. She is a cultural anthropologist. Afifa is currently visiting Malaysia to give a series of talks on parenting and education. So one of the talks Afifa will be giving, which is on the challenges facing young parents, will be happening on the 28th of June. So for more information on that, you can go to their Instagram page, which is at Crescent Collective. That is CRESCENT Collective. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segment, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.